Hello world. You're listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. KWLUG discusses topics related to free and open source software of all kinds. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license, so you can give it to others, remix it, or even sell it, provided you abide by the terms of the license and share alike the works that you remix and redistribute. For more information about KWLUG, visit kwlug.org. For more information about this podcast, visit kwlug.org/podcasts. In this month's meeting, Kyle Murphy demonstrates how he uses Krita, the digital painting program, and Bob B. shows off his home lab.
Okay, perfect. Got Krita open here. I've maximized my screen. I mean, you can see anyways, if you're looking at the chat, so just so you know, I'm not actually seeing the chat. So if anyone wants to read me out any questions that appear there, that's fine. Okay. So just getting into Krita here, what I'm going to go over is, sort of what I use Krita for. Some of the more common uses for Krita, maybe get into a couple like little advanced or kind of cool things. And I'll also skip past some of the stuff I don't use and just explain why I don't use it. We'll get into Krita's overlap with Blender and also just, we'll just sort of work through it like that. I'm going to move past some of the things I don't typically use, and I'll explain why I don't use them. So creating a new document inside of Krita, like a lot of programs now. So for instance, if you're into digital painting, you might work like two or three times larger than the canvas you're working on. So handy feature where you can just multiply the resolution you want to work at. But I'm, for the sake of memory, just not going to work at those levels. So create a new canvas. You might not be able to see a big difference between my canvas and the border. It's because I work in a mid-tone gray just to be able to see things better. So this might be similar to what you see when you open it up. And the first thing you'll notice is just on the right side here, tons and tons of brushes. So Krita is well known for digital painting. It's set up that way. And I'll just quickly go through on the left side here, some of the tools. And we'll start with the vector tools, which I don't use. And I'll explain why. It's because if you're gonna do vector work, I really recommend that you use something like Inkscape. It is built in though. So you got your various tools, shape tools. Text is really terrible inside of Krita. At least I'm on 4.1, so I don't know if they're improving that. I think the current stable version is 4.5. They're coming out with 5 soon. But I know some illustrators, cartoonists, they'll use Krita for all their illustration, and then they'll take it into Inkscape if they want to work on text and shapes, because the functionality just isn't that great inside of Krita. But what we do have in Krita is a ton of brushes. So I'll just go through some of those with you now. So I'm using a Wacom tablet. And what you might see here, if the resolution's good, it's very good at sensing the pressure on the tablet. So I'm just lightly painting across the tablet. And heavier strokes here. A lot of brushes work that way, but some brushes instead of opacity, it works on the width of the stroke. So heavier pressure, larger stroke, lighter pressure, light stroke. Works in layers as well, but that's pretty standard nowadays. And when I used to teach some of this in class, one of the first things I always had people do is just go through the brushes and figure out which ones you like, because you've got this tag option where you can create a tag and you right-click your brush and you assign it to the tag you created, and you sort of create your own collection of brushes, because if you're just working from the general list of brushes, you've got really too much choice there. But there's some neat stuff you can do with it. So we'll go through some of that. So some brushes have kind of a dry sort of effect. So I mean, again, the pressure that I'm placing on the Wacom tablet determines what kind of stroke I get on the screen. There is an option as well to go through the tool settings, and actually I'll go through them here instead, to define all kinds of additional options with that particular brush. I personally tend to leave this alone a little bit, because if I don't find the brush that I want, that I'm currently using, usually searching through and finding another brush will get me something that I want. Hitting delete on the keyboard, you'll instantly take out anything on the layer you've got selected. And insert gives you a new layer. So I'll just show a couple of the brushes that I like here. You've got your sketch brush, and you get some very cool effects there. Even with the mouse, this can make some very interesting images. I don't really know what I'm drawing here. Maybe an alligator. And the way this particular brush is interacting is, as long as I don't move it off the canvas, it interacts with any previous lines I've drawn. So I can go back, get close, and it's kind of like an ink bleed effect. But if I start a new line, it won't bleed into that previous brush anymore. As well, there's some things that try to imitate sort of a watercolor kind of brush. So I'm coloring in my image here. Hitting E on the keyboard instantly transfers something. It changes your brush into an eraser. And then these watercolor brushes themselves, their relation to the Wacom is, the lighter you go on the Wacom tablet, the more they start to blend in the color. And if you go heavy on the Wacom, on the tablet, all of a sudden you get the color. And so it's a nice mixing tool. Yeah. So as well, I mean, there's other illustration features that are useful. You can set a mirror mode. So, let's go black. There we go. So, you want to do your little portrait of someone, creating something that way, you can. And then just nice time saver, because you can then use to that same mirror feature to quickly color something in. And when you're done, turn off the mirroring, and now you can get into things like shading. So I don't know where my light source is. Maybe it's coming from the side. So you might start to darken some areas and lighten some others. Yeah. So I don't use the vector tools, but I do use quite frequently the selection tools, which are almost the same, but it lets you sort of cordon off a section of your image. Krita has a gradient tool like most programs, but it's got this really great feature to it. It's got an erase option, just like with the brushes. So you hit E, you turn your gradient into an eraser, and now you can start to gradient erase parts of the image. And I'll show a little bit later how I use that in some of the game design work that I do, because it comes in really handy in blending an image. So I think Krita 4 is the first, maybe I'm wrong on this, is the first version of Krita to add in clipping groups. And this is nice because I've got it unselected, but you can create these mask layers. And this didn't used to be a feature inside of Krita. And that was really one of the only advantages that something like Photoshop had, was that it had that that masking feature where essentially you can limit any painting to only inside of the image that you've got. So I paint out here and it does nothing, but I start to get inside the image and it only affects that base image there. So handy for things like lighting, shading, things like that. And it's certainly a useful addition. So I think I upgraded from a Krita version 2.something, and that feature wasn't in there, but it is now, and so it's a handy drawing feature. So you can sort of confine all of your, if you're into digital painting, confine your primary light source, your environmental light source, and your secondary light source, all within the image that you're working on. And then take that that clipping group and move it as you need on the page without affecting anything else. I've got a layer here for the shadow. And there we go. Okay. So as well, I mean, all of these brush categories, they could kind of fill their own, or altogether they could certainly be an hour or more of a tutorial. So I'm just going to skip to some of the ones I use a bit more frequently. So we have the sketch brushes, digital brushes, and the texture brushes, which are really nice. One thing with digital painting is that very difficult to make it look as if it's not digital. So it's usually very obvious when something is digital and not traditional. So textures help to alleviate that. So I'm putting that over the page, but I might take that texture and reduce it to like 6%. If I zoom in, you can kind of see those textures. But adding textures to an image across the entire image, it's kind of like mirroring a canvas style effect, and can really unify the entire image. As well, I'm going to duplicate the sphere. And I don't use a ton of filters, but I'll go into a couple that I do use here. Gaussian blur, which is really effective, and you may not even see it on the screen. I'll make it a bit more obvious, but I mean, even objects in real life don't tend to be perfectly crisp. So that can be a nice little cheat or shortcut to create a little bit more realism in the image. I'll show one other thing inside of filters that I use from time to time, and that's auto contrast. And Krita doesn't typically get this right, but I'll still use it and get kind of a sense of, is that better or worse? And sometimes it's a halfway in between, so you might move the opacity down to get something. And all of your options here can turn off a layer. And so that probably does look better with a little bit higher contrast there. Something else I'm going to go into here is just, so with Krita 5, what they're really promoting with it is the animation feature. And so you can create your animated GIFs. You've got your time frame down here. And it's kind of a neat feature. You can create, as well, video files that you can, if you do video editing, you can then insert them into what you're working on. So I'll just do a quick demonstration here. I'm not going to do all 100 frames. I'll just do about 10 or 12. And we'll have it end at 12 frames and run our animation. And we've got our little GIF, and you could, you know, animate whatever you want, draw whatever you like. But that's just an example there. And when you go to it out, you can go as, you can just animate each frame as a PNG. You can animate it out as a video. One of which is the options to do as a GIF animated file, MPEG 4. I don't know what Matroska is. I don't know video editing enough. But yeah, so if you do video editing, though, you're going to find one of those is going to fit in with what you're working on. And or you could edit them out as both. And I will just edit this or send this out. And so there's the various frames right there. And so if you do use video editing software, you can then just take those and insert them as a frame by frame animation inside of it. Here's something a long time ago. Again, as part of game dev. That's just Krita. And that's also just showing that that mirror style drawing as drew this character in pieces and then animated it through the separate render animations. Okay, any questions up to now? Can I slow down? What are people thinking?
I have a question. So, how do you group things? Like, is it generally layers? So say you were doing an animation with that guy's cape or whatever. Mm-hmm. Are each of those things in a separate layer and then you move them over? Because I know in vectors, you just group the vectors together and then you can move them arbitrarily. But in paint programs, I don't know what the mechanism is for taking grouped things and keeping them together and moving and altering them as a group.
Yeah, in this case, they were separate layers. So you can, so for instance, I'll just draw a little something right here. And then I'll do that, that clipping group. So that clipping group has to be really on its own time frame. If I want to animate anything alongside of it, as far as I know, I'm going to have to make that as a separate layer or as a separate time frame and choose the options for it differently. It can't just be part of this group, if that makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. There was also a comment in the chat about Synfig versus Krita for animation, and Michael was saying that he found Synfig really clunky and unstable. Do you have any thoughts on the two compared to each other?
I thought I might be out of date on this. I thought Synfig was abandoned. Is it still being worked on?
Michael says he'd have to double check.
Okay. Because yeah, I do remember Synfig even being considered a substitute for Flash, but I sort of lost track. Yeah, Krita is making animation much more prominent on the platform. They're really focusing on it. So I'd expect it to get more stable and more features to be added.
Michael says that there were commits to Synfig as of yesterday. So if it's been abandoned, it was abandoned today.
Okay, I'm not that up to date. So no, I may be totally confusing it with something else. Yeah.
Bob asks, if your Wacom tablet, is it a monitor or is it a drawing surface separate from your display?
Yeah, it's a separate surface, yeah.
Do you find that actually coordinating what's on your screen and what your hands are doing difficult when you're using such a tablet?
At first, yeah, but after some, I mean, traditional drawing classes that I took, the teacher was always big on the fact that you shouldn't be looking at your page or your hands anyways, which seems counterintuitive because how do you know how the image is coming out if you're not looking at it? But you should just be like what I'm doing right now. You should just be looking at your screen or looking away, from your hands and what your hands are doing. So it's a little bit easier than traditional drawing. There's a lot of traditional illustrators. They're not looking at their page or their hands. They're looking at the subject that they're drawing or trying to capture on the page. Okay. So before I go into some of the stuff I'm doing with the game design stuff, I'll give something as a resource. Try it down. Okay. So I wanted to give this as a resource, even though I don't necessarily think it's that potentially that useful. So it is something you can do with Krita. But now with Blender, you might see some of the tools that are available where you can just paint directly onto your models. But this is something I worked out a while ago because instead of taking the time to actually get good at shaders and things like that inside of Blender, I was looking for workarounds or shortcuts. And so I've got this video here that sort of goes through that. And gives you a way to use Krita to just paint exactly what you want to see onto your Blender models. So it goes into UV unwrapping your Blender model and exporting it and then putting it onto your model inside of Krita. But it gets its own video. It might be with the recent advancements in Blender, it might be kind of out of date, but it is some ways to paint things directly onto your models, and you might find it kind of interesting and useful. So I'll copy and paste this down into the chat and leave this as a link for anyone who might be interested. You can kind of see what I'm doing here. So rendering the model of Krita. It's not real time, but you almost get a real time update to what you'd like to create on your 3D models. Bring that in the chat there. Okay. So I'll talk a little bit in the practical sense of what I use Krita for. I am working on an indie game. You can kind of see an example of it here. The game engine is Construct. Most of the characters are in Inkscape. The backgrounds are done through a combination of Krita and Blender. And between the two of them, the reason I use them is I'm going for sort of a lot of variety in my game. Creating a lot of characters, but also I want to create a lot of backgrounds. So I don't want the player to see the same background twice. I don't want the player to see the same characters twice. And the way that I can do that is through that combination of Krita and Blender, which I'll go into now. So one thing I need for any sort of layout, sort of battlefield, I need a floor and I need a sky. And sometimes I can do both inside a Blender, but more often than not, I need to do a combination of Blender and Krita. And either way, I'll do the composite work inside of Krita. So here's an idea of some of the backgrounds, the environments that I've done. And each of these is relatively short, relatively straightforward in terms of implementing. So I'll just run this layout now. And you got the various game characters and, I got some actions associated with them and such, but just being able to swap out this background, being able to swap out characters, enemies, all that kind of stuff, really streamlines the process and lets me do a large amount of content. So I'll just go through so how I do that. So sometimes I will use see if I can find it here. Sometimes I'll do something that's entirely Blender. So this right here was generated entirely in Blender. Sometimes I might paint kind of a really basic, lazy background with the floor being in Blender. But most of the time, I'll try to find some kind of skyline. And it might be from a photograph, or it might be if you're on, or if you know the site Art Breeder, it might be some kind of procedurally generated sky. So that's what I created as a presentation, or for this presentation. Before I go into that, speaking of the floors, and if you're interested in Blender, there's this great program called Materialize. And what Materialize does, it's free. It was developed by some special effects studio. They work in television and movies. But all you need is a 2D texture. And what it does is it generates all of the maps that you need for use in Blender. And on top of that, it names them appropriately when you go to save the project. So I'll create a height map, the normal map, and anything else I need that I think is appropriate. So metallic map, smoothness. Blender doesn't use an ambient occlusion map, and I don't know what an edge map is, so we'll just show them. And now you can see you get this rough, bumpy material now that all the maps are applied, all generated from just having a standard snapshot of a material. So that's what I did in Blender. So just go through the steps here. So give it a principled map. A neat trick in Blender, you want to make sure this thing called Node Wrangler is checked off. So that's a great add-on. You do Control Shift, and all you do is select all your maps, whether you've created them yourself to Materialize or gotten them from somewhere else. Set them. Try that again. You select them, as long as they're named properly, which Materialize does, it sets up all of your nodes for you. So you can then zoom into the material, scale it the way that you want. Usually the normal map I find needs a little bit of playing with. And then whether you use cycles or whether you use Eevee, you can then render that out. So I've already rendered this one. And all it is that floor. And then inside of, again, I mentioned the site Art Breeder, I created a procedurally generated sky right here. And so I'll just show how I might go towards putting that background together. So something like that. And this is where that gradient erase tool comes in handy, because I'm just going to try to blend these guys together. And that's kind of okay like that. The colors don't match, but I'll insert a new layer. Grab color from the background and then do a gradient across the image. Set it as a color layer, and then it's too strong, so we'll bring it back to some degree that kind of matches. From here, I might flatten the image and typically duplicate it. And again, one of the only filters that I use, it's really handy, that Gaussian burst. The copied image, which again we do the gradient erase to create a blurred background and a sharper foreground. And then there could always be a bunch of other stuff I do with the image. Like I might play with the colors more, with more of those color layers. But you get the idea from that. So I will save this. And then it now becomes something that I can instantly sort of swap out inside of the game engine here as a new background. I run the image, see if I like it or not. And yeah, I don't know. So I look at that. I think the foreground's a little bit too shiny, not rough enough. So I might make some changes there. But overall, this could be something that I then go on to keep and use inside of the game. Okay. I feel like I kind of blasted through everything I wanted to say, but we're getting close to 8 o'clock. Any questions from here? Any comments? I mean, this all kind of makes sense to me, but I get it if it doesn't make sense if I'm explaining it, and that'd be good for me to know. So yeah, questions, comments, anything like that?
So where does Blender come into this?
So Blender is part of the, so what's the floor area of the maps that I'm using? I'll create the ground environment essentially through Blender, and then use Krita as a composite tool to then blend it with, again, whether it's a photograph or something from ArtBreeder or whatever the case may be. Blender's the ground and Krita's the composite tool.
So then the result of that is that you're just getting a static PNG image that you're using as the background in your
game. It's a 2D image, yeah.
Okay. Michael has a question. How does Krita compare to GIMP? There seems to be a lot of overlap.
I use GIMP from time to time. There's just, Krita just seems to be set up to just go ahead and paint right away. That's always been my encounters with it. I personally don't find GIMP particularly user friendly, but it is closer to Photoshop and closer to trying to emulate the kinds of things that Photoshop provides. Krita is not trying to be a complete substitute for Photoshop. Krita is a painting tool.
So does that, am I right, sort of an approximation of, if I was starting from a photo and wanted to manipulate it and create something, I would probably start with something like Git, but if I was creating a digital image directly just by painting it, Krita might be the right way to go?
Yeah, totally. So GIMP's going to have a lot more options as far as photo manipulation goes. Krita is, intentionally limited on the filter side of things. Very few in comparison either to GIMP or to Photoshop.
Interesting. Yeah, so I guess you could, so say, for example, you could create an image that was somewhat photorealistic and end up in Krita doing some of the same things that you might do to a photo in GIMP, but just not really its strength.
Yeah, totally.
Michael mentions that he says Krita seems more approachable. Maybe on the point of being approachable, do you have any suggestions for tutorials or like ways, things that would lead you through getting started, especially for the non-artists among us?
When I taught it, I mean, I used to, my first suggestion was going through the brushes, seeing what each does, and understanding that some of them aren't going to do anything. There's plenty of good beginner tutorials on Krita. My honest answer is that learn, also do tutorials on learning the basics of art, of traditional art. Whether it's through a YouTube tutorial or any other resource, it's just going to carry over, and you're going to be better off for it. just to get those fundamentals for traditional painting, and then you see how Krita overlaps with that. I don't think that was the most helpful answer in the world. I get that, but that's honestly how I feel.
No, well, I think that probably does. It gives me an idea that it makes it sound like Krita is not so complicated that if you actually got an idea of sort of how to, if you knew how to draw and paint at a basic level, you would probably be able to handle and understand Krita relatively easily because it's expressing the concepts that you would have already covered in your regular painting and drawing.
Yeah. The artists that I follow with that traditional background, and they may have learned years ago, they have very little difficulty going over into the digital background. It's a lot of self-taught artists who have talent, but they don't have the basics behind them, who really struggle when they go over into the digital world. So yeah, getting the basics, getting the fundamentals makes it so much easier to transition to digital.
Yes, I think that is good to know.
So Bob has a question asking about the compatibility of Wacom tablets with a Linux desktop, if they're easy to set up, and if there's a cheap entry point as far as digitizing tablets go to try it.
Yeah, I think some of the tablets nowadays, so when I first got into it, and the tablet I've got here, back when I bought it over 10 years ago, so it was $600, now quality tablets are coming out that are like $50 to $80. It's the entry point isn't actually that bad now. And it's not like the tablets themselves are cheap. They're still quality tablets. With a Linux desktop though, as the first part of your question, no idea. I haven't heard anyone having difficulties. I mean, I haven't heard anyone having difficulties with it. So I can't speak to that part of it. But with the number of people who paint in Krita and are on Linux, my guess is no issues, but I don't know.
Do you have any suggestions of quality but cheap models of tablets to try? Are they all made by Wacom, or there particular brand lines that are better or worse if you want to try as a starter tablet?
I think Wacom has a, or Wacom, I don't know what the pronunciation is, but I think they have the bamboo variant Wacom, which is the cheaper entry level tablet. So Wacom bamboo.
Okay. Do we have other questions for Kyle or comments?
Do you have a place to follow up on your game yet, or is that something you'll have to tell us about in the future?
Really, I mean, my Twitter account is where I do everything game related, so I can share that. I can share that here, but that's the at the moment that's the only place I have anything dedicated to my game. So anyone wants to follow up on that, that'd be great. It's a turn-based RPG. So if you like that style of game, maybe you want to follow along and see as it develops.
So hi guys, my name is Bob, and last month I asked if anybody wanted a tour of my home lab. Not quite sure what I was thinking at the time or how it would manifest itself, but I'm gonna do a run through of all the stuff I run in my house and entertain any questions, and that's about it. So I'm going to start by the obligatory picture of the rack in the basement. So starting with that heats my house basically, occasionally. But I will walk through what's there and some of the stuff that's running on top of it. So like I said, I have a bit of an outline on my notes over here, and I'll try to blast through that. But if anybody has any questions, just feel free to jump in anytime. All right, so starting with this, at the top of my rack, I have DSL service to my house, which is what this modem is up here. I have a /27 public IP address range that was assigned to me from the ISP, and that feeds into a pfSense firewall, which is this little generic black box sitting underneath it. So I'm going to start by logging into that and showing you what I have there. Oops. So this is my pfSense box. I have a whole bunch of sub-interfaces connected to it. So there is one WAN interface, which is the public-facing side of it. And I have another interface which faces the inside of my network, and it's broken out into a bunch of VLANs, which feeds my switch. So the setup in my basement is basically my lab, but it's also my my brother shares it with me. So he moved down to Texas, and when he moved, he dumped his home lab into my basement, and we consolidated all. So, okay, so these are the VLANs that I have in my house. Some of them, here's my segment. Here's my brother's segment somewhere in here. Actually, he's not VLAN, he's just untagged. We have a storage segment and a couple of other segments which are kind of not being used. I tried to do something for management, which never really went anywhere. I tried to do an IoT segment, which never really went anywhere, but I haven't cleaned this up very well. The other point about the firewall is my brother lives in Texas. My mother lives in Mississauga. My in-laws live in Stony Creek. My brother's in-laws live in somewhere out near Kitchener. I don't remember the name of the place because I'm on a podium and I can't think well. But what we did is we set up a VPN to all of these places. So my house is the why is this not working? So if you click on the right window, my house is the hub, and all of these places are the spokes. So what you can see here is with OpenVPN, I have all of these places connected to my house, and I can reach into all of these networks at their homes. For example, you know, my mom has a VPN into here, and I have a Proxmox machine running at her place that I do offsite backups to. The spokes can talk to each other, to answer your question, Paul, if they're configured in. I know some of them can talk to each other, but I haven't done a complete, it's not a mesh, but I haven't done a mesh of reachability through the hub for everybody, because not everybody needs to speak to each other. So again, this is my in-laws, this is my brother's in-laws, this is my brother, this is my mom. We also rent a server out of a provider called OVH out in Montreal, where we run our mail server. And then I have a little machine that I've got deployed at my employer sitting in their rack, which also gives me a small slash 29 that I can mess with as well. The VPNs. So this is a pfSense box, for those of you that can't tell by the logo in the upper left-hand corner. The box that's sitting at my mom's house is also a pfSense, but they had these on sale for a while. They don't sell them anymore, but I think this is like the cutest thing I've ever seen. So I bought a bunch of them when they came out, and I've got this deployed at my mom's house. And that's an SSD hard drive just for scale, so you can get a feel for how big this is. So I have that deployed at my in-laws. I have that deployed at my mom's. And I don't know what my brother did at his place and his in-laws, but it's also pfSense. That particular model, Paul, is that what you're asking? It's an ARM. This particular red one is an ARM box. And the model of it was from Netgate, and it was an SG1000. And they definitely don't sell these anymore. They're something else a bit bigger and a bit more expensive. And less cute, I gotta say. Well, that's a firewall. So it runs the pfSense software. So it has the same interface that I have here, actually. If you log into my mom's, or if I log into my mom's. So, mom, where are you? So it's running the same firewall software that I have in my basement, only it's not holding multiple networks on it. It's just basically got the one network at her place. So she surfs the internet with one computer that she has and an iPad that she has, and I get to use a server in the basement for offsite backups. So she has a much simplified firewall setup than I do here. Okay. What else can I show you here? So we also, like I was saying, we also have a server in Montreal, and I also have a server down at my employer's. The difference being is that those are running as virtual machines inside of a hypervisor and not as standalone firewalls. Like you can see for this guy, this is a discrete box. So it's running pfSense bare metal on here. I used to have it as a virtual machine, but that tended to cause problems because my brother would do software updates remotely and he would end up cutting himself off when the virtual firewall went down with the hypervisor for a reboot. So I just found it to be easier to run it as a discrete box separately on the network from the hypervisors. All right. So the networking tools that I use here, or the networking stuff that I use, is primarily Ubiquiti. So let me just show you a picture of that. So I have a 10 gigabit switch, which, hang on, let me make this a little, size this a little bit better. There is a Ubiquiti switch, and there's a Ubiquiti 10 gigabit switch down here. It's a 16 port 10 gigabit switch, and I use that for the storage segment of the hypervisors. And that's pretty much it. So that's here. And there is also a 48 port switch Ubiquiti sitting at the top of the rack here. So there's a bit of a patch panel that runs to the other parts of the house. And then there is this 48 port switch, which mostly just feeds the stuff in the rack. It does PoE, so it's feeding an access point from here as well. And again, I'm able to peel off a couple of VLANs from here and just have stuff separated from my brother and myself. Okay, now to show you the Ubiquiti stuff. So part of my presentation, what I'm hoping to do is actually to show you some of the software interfaces as well for the equipment that I'm using, and hopefully that'll be of some value to some folks. So this is what the Ubiquiti dashboard looks like. The interesting thing that I just discovered in part of preparing for this presentation was Ubiquiti also does a graphical representation of your network. So if you buy into the Ubiquiti ecosystem where you use one of their gateways, this picture is a lot more comprehensive, but you can just see all of the things that show up on my network here. And so you can see the 48 port switch here. You can see it feeding one access point here. You could see it feeding this little 8-port Ubiquiti switch, which is upstairs in the office where I'm sitting. And then this switch is also feeding an access point. And so these are the devices that I have plugged in at my desk. And these are the devices that happen to have bound to this access point, which is upstairs in the house. From a standpoint of hardware, if you go into the UniFi interface, you can actually see the devices here. So there's the 48-port switch. And you kind of, this is how you manage it. So if you wanted to, you know, assign a profile to the port, you would do that here. And then you could assign it a profile to dictate which VLANs show up there and in what state they show up. So they can be untagged or tagged. You can send it as a trunk and connect to the other devices on the networks that way. So you can see here the two access points, which are end of life, which are going to need to be replaced soon. There's the 10 gigabit switch, and then there's the 8-port switch here. So one thing about this one that my kids hate, I actually broke out the two networks into one for them and one for the rest of the household, because I can do stuff like set up a schedule where I shut off the Wi-Fi at a certain time of the day so I don't have to compete with them for attention during dinner time. And sorry, I just noticed the questions in the chat. So Paul, yeah, all of the switches are managed. The reason I went with Ubiquiti, because it seemed like a good value for the money. Like that 10 gigabit switch at 16 ports at the time that I bought it a couple of years ago was like sub $1,000. Like, and for 10 gigabit switch, it has 12 SFP plus slots and four copper 10 gigabit RJ45 ports on it, and at the price point, like, just couldn't beat it. And it integrated with the rest of the stuff that I had on my network too, because I already had the cloud key. So it's just, it's trivial for me to manage it and integrate it into my system here. All right. So moving on. going to turn to the hypervisors stack now. So let me show you where that lives in the rack. So I don't know if you can see very well down here, but there's three 1U HP DL something or other servers. And I got to say too, all of this hardware that you're seeing here, it's pretty much all inherited from clients that they were throwing out stuff into the garbage. And I basically said, hey, can I have that? I'll wipe all the hard drives, I promise. And they gave it to me. So I ended up inheriting these three hypervisors. I ended up inheriting some, you can see these guys here. Actually, sorry, let me get the mouse in the right window. You can see these guys here. These are actually parts of an Avamar backup grid. They're actually Intel servers. They're not very good, but they do have 12 slots for 3.5-inch hard drives on the front. And this mess that you're seeing over here is me playing with it to try to get my own SAS cards so that I can address each one of these hard drives individually from the server so I could throw stuff on there where I could do something like ZFS instead of having to use the RAID card that comes inside of it. So, and actually on the topic of inheriting hardware, this was from one decommission. I just recently decommissioned the DR site, which corresponded to the stuff that I inherited. And this was the haul that I took home last time. This over here is an EMC VNXE grid. And so you're looking at like 45 hard drives. These are 600 gigabyte 15K SAS drives. So I don't know what that works out to in terms of storage, but what I found is that these shelves are completely generic SAS addressable. So you buy a SAS controller off of eBay and you get the right cables and you can address each one of these hard drives individually from a computer. And I'll show you that further down on the in the presentation. And so these are the similar to the three servers that I already have. So I inherited another set of three in the basement. All right. So moving on, those three machines, I did a presentation, I think it was a couple of years ago, where I did OpenVAS, and part of that I rolled into a quick presentation on Proxmox. So that's what I'm using here at the house. So, and this is what a Proxmox UI looks like. PXYACO, where are you? So I don't have a subscription for it, but it's fully featured even if you don't get a subscription for it. And so what you see here are three nodes. So three, so I can run high availability. PXYACO, YACO WACO, dot appears somewhere in here. So it's an Animaniacs theme on this go around. We used to have a Simpsons theme. And I can't remember what our first cluster was, but it was some other cartoony name. So PXYACO, these are all the virtual machines I have running on it. My brother, who is much more organized than I am, has much fewer machines running on it. And then PXPinky is one of those Intel boxes, which is much less powerful, but basically it serves as a witness for these other two. So if one of these guys goes down, they have a quorum and they know that the virtual machines need to be sparked up between them. They actually have a bit of shared storage as part of Proxmox, so they can see the whole configuration of the whole cluster. Part of the configuration is also storage. And so what you see here is SAS 15K disks that we've repurposed, but we also replaced one of the shelves disks with a bunch of SATA 7200 RPMs. So that's the beautiful thing about SAS is SAS disks, they're enterprise grade, but you can also shove in SATA disks and a SAS controller will happily work with them for what they are. So that whole, I have one of those shelves sitting in my rack, this guy right here, and it's connected via a SAS cable into this hypervisor up. Actually, it's not even a hypervisor. It's running Open Media Vault, but it's got a SAS connector. And it can see each one of these hard drives here. And so this set of hard drives here is the 15K 600 gigabyte drives that are built into one ZFS array. And these guys over here are clunky old 7200. I think they're 2 terabyte disks made into another ZFS array. And all of those are being presented from Open Media Vault, which I'll show you the UI for, from this machine here onto these two hypervisors. And that is what you see here. So these hypervisors, the virtual machines on these hypervisors have their backend QCAL2 files living on that disk array fed through Open Media Vault, if that makes sense to you guys. The other thing I was going to say is the third machine in this cluster is running PBS. PBS is the Proxmox backup server. I have a cloud in my basement. Yes, and it rains too occasionally. It's not quite as nice as the cloud, but it's getting there, hopefully, or hopefully not. So I want to hear about Docker. I want to know what I can do with that. PBS, Proxmox backup server. So my brother would be able to address this stuff. I'm not 100% certain how it works, but basically all of these virtual machines are backed up onto this Proxmox utility here. It does deduplication and compression. So it does a very efficient job of backing all of that stuff up. And I think there's also some replication that happens here, because I know he has PBS servers running at the Montreal hypervisor, and I know he has PBS running at his place in Texas, and I think he pushes out backups to here, but I'm not 100% certain on that. You also notice this machine here, there's two Open Media Vault servers running. He has one running on here, and he does stuff like Time Machine backups to it from his place, but we also have another Open Media Vault server, again, which is feeding the actual hypervisors here. Just looking through my notes here. The one other point that I wanted to make about OVM Pinky. So this is, where's the picture? This guy right here, he is the Intel server. Inside of this machine, there is a fiber channel card. That fiber channel card is PCI passed through the hypervisor into this virtual machine. So, and I can show you that here, OVM Pinky sees the fiber channel card. So from OVM Pinky, and I'll show you this. So if I log on to PX Pinky, I actually have the tape library. Oh, where is it? Sorry, wrong machine. PX Pinky is the hypervisor. OMV Pinky is the actual virtual machine. And the virtual machine has 24 slot tape changer on it, which I kind of use to archive stuff. Occasionally when I know that hard drives are dying, I'll dump a bunch of stuff onto one of these tape cartridges. They're about 2.8 terabytes each. And then I have the robot can load them and unload them for me. In the rack itself, you actually see that down here. And in the back of the rack picture, let me bring that up. It's actually connected by this red fiber optic cable. So here's the tape drive. The tape has a fiber optic connection, goes up because it's too long of a cord, and it comes into the Pinky machine, and then PCI pass-through passes it into that virtual machine where I get to interact with it from a shell on the OMV Pinky virtual machine. All right. Okay. So the hypervisors themselves, I mentioned I have two instances of Open Media Vault. There's this one here, which is just running file shares, but there is also this guy here. This third pizza box. So these two are running Proxmox. This one is running Proxmox, but the mate of these three is actually running Open Media Vault bare metal, because we couldn't get PCI pass through working on these HPDL boxes. There was a known problem. We found some discussions on a forum, and there was no real workaround, like even with firmware updates and all that other stuff. So PCI pass through is kind of, it works, but sometimes it works except when it doesn't work. And this is one of those instances where it didn't work, and we had to resort to doing it this way. And because the SAS card is in this guy, what we were hoping to do was PCI pass through and run Open Media Vault, passing this array into a virtual machine, but we couldn't do it. So we ended up running Open Media Vault bare metal on this pizza box here. and I'll just show you the user interface for Open Media Vault. And then there's the third Animaniac there, dot. And then this is what Open Media Vault looks like. So in terms of the disks, so you can see all of the disks from that disk shelf sitting inside of here. So these guys are the Hitachi SAS Enterprise disks, the 15K RPM ones. And then these are the old 7200 SATA clunkers. And these guys are built into, I don't know if I can see it here. Yeah, so here's where I thought it was ZFS. I guess he didn't use ZFS after all. So this is where the arrays are built. And then from here, this is where NFS is exported up to the hypervisors. Actually, I don't know if I showed you that. So if you go in here, you can actually see these are the mounts from those two. So if you look at the NFS mounts, right, this is on the 10 gigabit network. This is the mount point off of Open Media Vault dot where the hypervisors store their images. Sorry, I should ask, you guys still good? Is this okay pace? Am I talking too much? Am I talking too little? Any questions up to this point?
I do have one question. We'll see if anybody else asks one too. Is sure. Open Media Vault is then like the central place where everything else looks for files, and then Open Media Vault talks to all the disks? Or have I misunderstood something?
No, you got that right. So there's two instances of Open Media Vault. The big one that's using that whole disk shelf is providing NFS to the hypervisors. So the hypervisors themselves, like any virtual machine, like let's say Plex, right? Inside of Plex, I have disks defined, and that disk is a QCount2 file, which is living on the SATA 7200 NFS mount from Open Media Vault. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. Okay.
And then, cool. To confuse matter, there, like I said, there is another Open Media Vault, which my brother uses for just Apple file shares and that kind of stuff. I don't really know what he does with it. It's just there to confuse me when I forget that we actually have two of them running in the rack.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the simplest possible world, you would stuff every single one of your like storage hard drives behind a single Open Media Vault, and everything right. would go through that one place.
Right. And ideally, if we could have got that PCI pass-through working, so we could have connected that disk shelf into a virtual machine, that's probably the way we would have done it. And then not have this business of two separate types of pieces of hardware, for one for Open Media Vault and, you know, one for the rest of the cluster. All right. Okay. So that's that one. So this is the cluster in my basement. I mentioned that we have a machine over in OVH. So again, Proxmox is the hypervisor of choice, just because the free version is fully functional. We actually do, there is a cheaper license you can get, PXOVH, and that's the one that we pay for over here. It does support, obviously, OTP, which I'm going to try to look up real quickly and show you what my OVH machine looks like. Part of this stuff running in my basement, I'm trying to find a balance. I really would love to run this stuff in the cloud instead of in my basement, just for the amount of noise and heat that it generates. But electricity is so much cheaper than renting cloud services that it just doesn't make sense. Like this OVH machine that we got over here is, you can see the specs on it here, right? Intel Xeon 3.8 gigahertz. I don't know how much RAM we have. Oh, there it is. This is a physical server that we rent out of OVH. And this costs $123 a month, right? Whereas, you know, all of these servers and other toys that I have running in my basement, you know, costs me something in electricity, but, you know, let's say it's $100 in electricity just to run this rack on a monthly basis. There's so much more stuff that I can do on this. right? And so that's always kind of like the inflection point that I'm looking for. When is it going to be cheap enough that I can get rid of this rack in my basement and just throw all this stuff out into somebody's cloud and not have to worry about that stuff anymore? And we're not there yet. But in terms of what we have in OVH, so just a quick tour of it. Again, there's a pfSense firewall fronting it. We actually run a mail server called Cario, which I just had heats my house. Don't laugh. My furnace actually broke down one winter, and the guy came out to my house, and the furnace happens to be in the same room as that stuff. And I go, you know, it's Saturday, it's freezing outside, like it was minus double digits outside. And I go, what am I supposed to do until Monday when you can get the part? And he goes, well, this room's pretty warm. I suggest you just run the fan on your furnace and maybe your gas fireplace, and you should be okay until Monday. So even he admitted that the rack was giving off enough heat that it would actually contribute to keeping my house warm when my furnace wasn't actually operational. Anyway, so Cario, mail server that I was using at a client's, it worked. We were fine. The house held, like between the gas fireplace and that room giving off enough heat and the furnace circulation fan being able to work. It was just the exhaust fan that was broken, so the burner couldn't burn, but the furnace could move air. So between those two heat generators, we were fine. Actually, it lasted until Tuesday because he couldn't get the part on Monday. Anyway, so... Oh, there's Proxmox backup server running over an OVH as well. All right. So going back to my notes. So the other one I wanted to show you. So this one is in Montreal. This one is in my basement. I didn't show you the one running at my mom's house, but it's pretty boring. This is one I just recently deployed at my employer. And so same deal. Like it's a Proxmox hypervisor, but one component of Proxmox that I wanted to show you was, so not only does Proxmox allow you to do virtual machines, but it also lets you do containers. So this machine is not running as KVM virtualization. It would be running as a container on here. And just to show you what kind of containers you can get, so you have something called templates that Proxmox provides. So if I wanted to start up a Proxmox mail gateway, which is one thing that I forgot to point out when we were looking at the OVH, that's a spam filtering service. Basically, it's the first thing that gets hit from inbound mail. It does a bunch of spam filtering, and then it passes it on to Cario. And Cario is where my brother uses a web UI to read his mail. I use Outlook over an Exchange connector to read my email that way. These are some of the container images that you can install basically in a single click. So if I wanted to run Ubuntu on this as a container, it's as simple as downloading the template and creating a container on here from it. They have operating systems, but they also have a bunch of things from Turnkey Linux. So, you know, if I ever wanted to, play with Redmine, right? It's as simple as downloading the template onto the hypervisor and then spinning up a container with it. And this kind of gives you an idea over the types of containers that you can just have up and running out of the box with like zero deep configuration inside of it. Yeah, I've never heard of it either until I started looking at Proxmox, but if anybody else knows anything about it, they can elaborate, but these are just the templates for containers that Proxmox has out of the box. So Jenkins, I know that's one of those buzzwords that goes along with Kubernetes that I know about, but don't really know how it relates to everything. You know, Node.js, again, I've heard that word too. And for all intents and purposes, like if you start up the container, right? You can console into it, which shows up on another screen here. And there you go. Right. So, right. And if I were to SSH into that hypervisor, PXCL, you can actually see that container eventually. There's the KVM, there's the virtual machine running on the box. I don't know where that box is. Oh, there it is. There is the LXC container and all of its sub processes running underneath it. And again, all of that is basically, you know, a couple of clicks from the hypervisor and you're done. Okay. So that goes back to that. One other part, I'm clicking on the window from Big Blue Button as opposed to the window that's actually presenting in Big Blue Button. One other thing that I wanted to show you was this aberration up here. So most of my hardware, again, is inherited. So I've always had these Super Micro drive chassis. I've had like a whole bunch of these, and they're SATA only. And I always wanted to get a server running where I could just plug disks into and bash about with them. And so that's what this box represents. So this server is called NASA, or for NAS-A at the time. And this is where I love to play with BTRFS file systems. And so a lot of the bulk storage that is independent of what my brother does on the network, I do on here so as not to disrupt any of the lab production type stuff. And so that's what this box is. Soon to be replaced with this guy down here, because I got a SAS card and an external adapter for it. So I'm going to connect one of these other EMC trays to that guy and see about moving all of that stuff off onto there. Paul, in terms of security, I mean, I have the pfSense as my firewall. I know my brother runs OpenVAS, so that's a security scanner on it, and he tells me if anything really abhorrent is running on the network. Not a whole hell of a lot of security going on it. Yeah, that's about really all I have to say about that. I mean, I try to stay up to date with patches and stuff like that, but, you know, I'm a couple of releases behind on a couple of these machines, so that's also not saying much. Does that answer your question? I don't actually need to spend a lot of time babysitting it. My brother does a lot of the administration stuff. Like, he's the one that set up the cluster when we were spinning these up. He's the one that basically tells me where to go and plug things into, or, you know, replace hard drives. Like, I was on vacation last month when during the last KW lug, and then one of these drives happened to fail on one of the hypervisors while we were out. And so, you know, when I got back, I basically replaced the hard drive with a spare one that we had kicking around, and that was my role in it. So honestly, like, unless I'm actually playing with it, like I've been playing with that new server, it really takes minimal amount of time per month. But again, my brother does a lot of the work on the stuff, so I don't know how much time he actually spends. All right. So moving on. One of the other things that I've been doing, and you can see it here. So within the Proxmox virtual environment, a couple of my machines are dedicated to LXC. So there was a presentation that the gentleman's name escapes me. He's the guy that does the recordings, Nikolai. So he did a presentation on LXD, and that kind of piqued my curiosity into that branch of containerization on Linux, because I had heard about Docker before that, and that was a little bit too difficult for me as a grumpy old system administrator to wrap my head around. But when he showed me LXD and he showed me spinning up a container inside of LXD, which was a version of Ubuntu, that was easier for me to wrap my head around. But when I started poking around LXD, like, I use Debian as my distribution of choice, just because that's what I've been using since like 1995 or around that time period when I got into this. So what I found on Debian, it wasn't LXD, it was LXC. And when I started looking around at that, I kind of learned the whole ecosystem around LXC. And what I did is I set up a virtual machine to play around with LXC on here. So I have within my lab, I have a virtual machine called LXC Lab. Yeah, except Docker, all those configuration files around it really confuse me. So what I did for LXC is I just bridged its internal network with my local network. So if I spin up an LXC container, it literally picks up an IP address off my main network from my DHCP server, and it's just another machine on my flat network. I don't have to worry about forwarding ports or anything crazy like that. It's just a small virtual machine. But my point to that was, this is what LXC looks like. And SSR is just an alias for SSH root. I know I shouldn't be logged in as a root, but I'm old. I don't care. It's my own stuff. Oh, actually, for that one, there's two of them. LXC Lab was the first one, and I did that as unprivileged containers, so it actually runs as Bob. And so these are all the containers that I have running on this one, right? So whenever I want to play with something or there's a piece of software I want to play around with, I'll spark up a small container instead of cranking up a Debian install of a virtual machine or cloning, let's say, one of my Debian machines to get a virtual machine going, right? So, you know, I wanted to learn about cockpit. So great. I just did an LXC create cockpit and I had a Debian machine running on my network in about 5 minutes. And so then I could play with cockpit on that. And when I was done with it, I should have deleted it, but it's just sitting here wasting nothing other than a little bit of disk space. This, I do actually run a production LXC container on it. So my Pi-hole server is actually running as a container inside of this LXC server. And the other one, Paul, to your point on security, I also have Open Canary, which is like a honeypot. So if anybody tries to scan my network, this thing will shoot me a whole bunch of emails saying, hey, somebody's trying to scan your network and hit a bunch of ports on this honeypot from this IP address. So I would actually get a bunch of alerts if somebody was poking around my network unexpectedly. That's one of my LXC servers. I also have an LXC host. I also run another Open Canary server. And this is where I was playing with WireGuard too. So, you know, had to learn about WireGuard. So instead of installing a whole brand new virtual machine, downloaded an instance of Debian and got going on WireGuard in a matter of 5 minutes as opposed to spinning up a brand new machine. So, like I said, Pi-hole. Maybe I'll show you quickly what the interface for that looks like. For those of you that haven't seen it, Pi-hole is a ad blocking, because nobody scans my network. Actually, that's a good point. So my brother said he was scanning my network. He's obviously not, since I'm not getting all the alarms for it. I got to take that up with him. So Pi-hole, So this is Pi-hole. I have five people living in my house, so there's a lot of DNS requests. And this does a pretty good job of blocking out a lot of the junk on the network. My wife occasionally asks me to turn it off because it, you know, won't let her get to some shopping sites that need to present spam to her in order for her to buy stuff. But that's pretty easy because you have an interface here where you can disable it for like 5 minutes. And then she can do what she needs to do and everything will revert back after 5 minutes and block the junk from the network. Okay, moving on. I also run Libre NMS. So Libre NMS is kind of like my monitoring tool. sensor block, I tried it. I never really got to a point where I was comfortable with it blocking stuff. I really don't like being draconian like that. I would rather talk to them and work it out with them to get them to do the right thing as opposed to blocking them. So, I mean, we do have a blackout from quarter to seven, just for dinner time again, so we don't have to compete for their attention with their Wi-Fi. And that seems to be enough for the time being. And the rest of the time, we can usually yell our way through it and get them to do the right thing with their computers. But okay, back to this. So Libre NMS, Softscape. So this is the monitoring tool that I have in my basement. So what I wanted to show you on here, so this is that NASA box. I had a warning because I dumped a bunch of stuff onto one of the disks there and it hit a threshold and I just acknowledged the alarm and now it's, I just left it on here as a reminder that I need to go and clean stuff up on there. Jane was a Myth TV server that I had running for the longest time, but I find I'm just not watching TV and the only thing I really care about to record enough is Saturday Night Live. And then I have an HD home run box with an over-the-air antenna and Plex is able to talk to it natively. So I have just been using Plex to record that when it was airing live for the time being. And I find, as much as I love Myth TV, I just don't have a use for it anymore. Anyway, going back to this, so the PF Sense box here, you can kind of group it. So here's all the firewalls that I monitor. So these are all, you know, my mom's on here, my in-laws, the one at my work, the one over at OVH is somewhere down here too, or it's this guy up here. But interesting things that you can peel off of here. So if I go to the PF Sense box, you know, I can see the utilization of the ports. So if I go to my WAN port, which is RE0, because I've done this enough times to know, you know, I can see the traffic utilization of what's been going on. And so overnight, there's stuff coming into my network for offsite backups that I'm pulling in, or that my brother is pushing in. And here's the backup that I push out to my mom's from my house. The other cool thing about it is you can actually do real-time monitoring. So this thing will pull via SNMP and pull out actual bandwidth on a 2-second interval basis. If I let that go for a bit, you can kind of see what I'm pulling right now. So the other thing that's interesting about this, again, it's SNMP based. So in order to configure that, right, just basically point it at the machine, make sure that the machine is speaking SNMP, and then you go to town on it. So you can pull off the storage, you know, monitor the processor utilization. The health is somewhere on here too, which I can't see right now, or maybe not on this one. I also have a couple of UPSs, so two of them. I'll show you the picture. It's these guys down here. So again, all found hardware. They were throwing them out, so I took them home, bought new batteries for them, and now I have nice UPSs that can hold the load for about 10 minutes in a power failure. Cool thing is that you can actually see interesting graphs about your power, right? Oh, that's not good. You can tell how much power you're consuming. You can see stuff like, you know, your estimated runtime on battery, right? 42 minutes is a lie. It will never run for 42 minutes on standby power. But, you know, at least you have some visibility into what's going on down there. What else can I show you off of here? Anything interesting? Yeah, not really. That's about all I wanted to show you off of that one. The other component, because I have this rack in my basement, I also have some stuff set up for power monitoring. So what I've got, and I'm just bringing up and scaling the picture, the power panel behind this stuff. So there's a company out of Waterloo region called Hydro. And what they do is they have cloud-based power monitoring. So these two components here are current transducers. This is my electrical panel up in here. So these are current transducers. I have two clamps on the legs coming into the house, so I monitor the entire house power utilization. And then I have another pair of current transducers, one that's dedicated to the rack and one that's I have an electric car. So one's that dedicated to the car charger. So I can tell what I'm, you know, kind of what I'm using there. Again, cloud-based, not my ideal, but you know, it is what it is. And so their user interface looks like this is what I can do there. So for example, live demand. So this is what my power utilization looks like. And so this is the mains on my house. Kind of seems wrong. I don't know what's going on here. But anyway, let's say over the last 24 hours. So let's say overnight, you can actually see when the air conditioner has kicked in because you'll see the power spikes on the utilization. And, you know, over longer periods of time here, you can see where I was charging the car because it does a massive hit on the power consumption of the household. And the computer itself, that whole rack in the basement has its own CT. So I can tell you right now I am pulling 1.3 kilowatts out of that rack. And I should probably do something about that because that seems high, but, you know, I'm having fun. So I really don't want to do too much with it. Some notable servers that I have running in my lab. I have MediaWiki running. So if I do anything significant, I try to document it, so I remember how to run the commands the next time. Sorry, Paul, just seeing your question. No, the UPSs are not tied into the network for the time being. That's like a low priority item on the to-do list. They tend to crash pretty ungracefully when the power goes out. It's happened a couple of times, and everything, knock on wood, has come up cleanly whenever that's happened. So should do that, just haven't gotten around to it, really. So notable software that I have, again, MediaWiki. Joplin, so thanks to somebody who presented that a few months back, I'm running Joplin as another note-taking device. John, yes, thank you very much. So running Joplin, Joplin itself, so I got that. That's actually the back end of that is tied into a server that's running out of OVH, and it's my brother maintains the Nextcloud server running in OVH, so I use that as the backend for Joplin with encryption. So none of the stuff in OVH is actually usable to anybody other than me who has the key. What else do I have? Plex for movies, and like I said, the over-the-air recording. I have that running here as a virtual machine. And that's the other nice thing about the HD Home Run. They're just network devices, and Plex automatically detected it and was able to see it. And it pulls down TV listings over the air, and I can schedule recordings. It was just so much simpler than Myth TV to run. I also have a really convoluted mail sorting program. One of my friends described it as a Rube Goldberg mail sorter. I was weaned on Procmail, so I know how Procmail works, and I'm spoiled rotten by what Procmail can do. That's why Sieve and any sort of network filtering that you can do in Outlook or Office 365 just doesn't cut it for me. So I can do crazy things like have files of email addresses, and I can run that through an egrep filter, and based on how it filters the mail, it takes it from my inbox and re-puts it up via IMAP to my mail server in a sub-mailbox. So that's how I sort my mail and try to keep all the automated emails going to a separate mailbox and not clutter up my main email flow. Also got free PBX running in here. Really, that only serves my desk phone up here. The whole house is running off of a terminal adapter that feeds my old phones and does a SIP connection to VoIP.ms for my main house phone number. Because Bell just, I find it ludicrous. They want to charge me $70 a month for a phone line, where free PBX charges me 80 cents for the phone number, $1.50 for 911 service, and 0.9 cent a minute for a phone call. So literally my phone costs less than $10 a month and everything works fine. That's story for another time. I use Windows for Outlook as a virtual machine. So this guy here is a Win10 box that I run Outlook on, because really it just works well for work. And as a mail client, I think that's probably the most usable one for me. I just haven't had the initiative to try picking up something else like Iceweasel, or what's the Mozilla one? That one looks intriguing. Thunderbird, thank you. I really would rather use that one, but just too much inertia and too much invested into Outlook. And it just does so much for me, like with calendars and contacts and mailboxes. I just can't be bothered to switch. Over at OVH, I talked about Carrio and Proxmox Mail Gateway. I talked about Nextcloud. I also run a little family tree program called GeneWeb, which tries to phone setup connected. So free PBX just has a trunk to VoIP.ms. So there's a couple of phone numbers that I have. When you dial them, they land on my free PBX virtual machine in the basement. And then my free PBX machine in the basement routes it up to a desk phone that I have sitting up here in my office. That's about all that I have with that. I mean, free PBX, I can show you. Free PBX. I think it's a under-provisioned machine, so it's not super fast, but it seems to work fine for what I'm using it for, which is not much. How is it cheaper? Again, it's about 80 cents for the phone number itself and 0.9 cent a minute for the phone calls. but the house phones are through a dedicated little box, like an SPA-112 from Cisco. So it's got an FXS port, which feeds the old style telephones in the house over a copper pair. And the other end of it just speaks SIP to VoIP.ms. Does that answer your question sufficiently, Paul? Correct. The cell phone is still, yeah. I'm not going to rant about the telecom situation in Canada. You guys talk about it on the mailing list enough. I totally get it. The cell phones that I have are paid for by work, so I don't care about those. The kids are on prepaid. My wife is on a super cheap plan where she doesn't do a lot with her phone when she's out of the house. So she has like 200 megabytes of data, and that allows me to pay for like for her cell phone around $15 a month, which is the price, which is what it's worth to me, right? I there's no way I'm paying $50 a month for her. I'll take a look at that one later, Jason. So Gene Webb, just real quick, if we got a couple of minutes, oh crap, we're at time. I'm almost at the end of my list. I won't show you Gene Webb. Future interests, like I talked about earlier, Docker. I really want to learn about Docker because I have a feeling that a lot of these virtual machines I can containerize into Docker and also maintain more currency, like be able to patch them a lot quicker just by virtue of the fact that they're pulling down Docker images as opposed to me having to log in, do a Debian update, and you know, take a snapshot and then mess with the software to try to do an update without screwing it up. And really getting rid of some hardware, because this stuff does chew up a lot of electricity, and I tend to hoard the hardware. And one of the topics of conversation that I'd love to talk about when we get together again face-to-face is how do you get rid of hardware? Because I have so much stuff in my basement that I just, it still has value for learning or for anybody that wants to run a server in the basement. So I can't take it to the dump yet. And it's driving my, yeah, both. Logistically, it's easy. I could just take it up to the dump. They have an e-waste thing. But psychologically, how do I convince myself? Well, sparks joy. Kinda, like when I get a SAS card working with an EMC shelf, that sparks a lot of joy, actually. Hey, Jason, you want some other servers? Because I got a bunch in my basement. As long as they don't go to the dump, I'm willing to part with them. How about some disk shelves? Anyway. And so the last point on my thing is I'd like to give a shout out to the selfhosted.show podcast, because they talk about a lot of the stuff that I'm trying to accomplish in my basement, and just kind of interesting to listen to somebody else talk about how what they're doing in their household. And so hopefully, you know, what I've talked about here hasn't bored you to tears, and hopefully, you know, if anybody wants to talk about any of the software that they've seen here and what I've done with it, more than willing to take that conversation up on the mailing list or in private. And that is where I would like to end it, please. So nested virtualization, Jason? Yes, it's doable. I vaguely remember trying it. I think my brother has tried it as well, and he managed to get it working, but it just wasn't something that we needed for our lab, so we never really pursued it. But I know it is possible, for sure.
What would you do with the nested virtualization?
So I'll drop this on you. So I know a guy that works at Microsoft in their cloud, and I could swear I heard him say one time that they run Hyper-V inside of Hyper-V, so that the Hyper-V virtualization that actually runs their virtualization infrastructure is actually virtualized itself, so they can vMotion hypervisors between hardware, which kind of blew my mind at the time.
Yes, I can see that, to be able to move things around. That would make sense.
Anyway, any actually, other? Sorry, go ahead.
I'm not even going to say, I think similar to what Jason's saying about using it in the classroom, I think I remember doing similar things when I've had Windows laptops and I wanted to run Linux and then wanted to run something nested inside of that. Good fun.
it's crazy. Like I look at where I started in the internet business, like around 1995. And, you know, I've at work, they're pushing all the cloud stuff, right? Cloud, everything cloud, right? And I've been sitting on some Microsoft presentations over the course of the last week. It is just insane what is going on and what they are capable of doing nowadays, right? And I look at that, I'm going, why the hell am I running all this crap in my basement? And it's like, oh yeah, because I don't want to take out a second mortgage to run it in the cloud because it ends up being very expensive at the end of the day. You know, the first hit's free and the first couple of hits are pretty cheap. But if you actually want to do anything significant, like if I wanted to run my infrastructure out in the cloud, it's going to cost me way more than I'm paying in electricity nowadays. So it stays in the basement.
Yeah, no, it's something I still haven't put any time into it, but for all the reasons you say, it does feel like it actually does make a lot of sense. And if you had easier systems to be able to basically do what you've done, like create your own cloud in your basement, and you can, you know, mostly run it in your basement, but then, you know, it breaks out to the actual cloud when you need it to. And
yeah, there's still something to be said for clicking connectors. Like that SaaS stuff that I have working, that big array, like I cannot tell you how happy that made me when we got that working. Like there's just something visceral about that that you just can't get by clicking a couple of buttons in Azure or AWS. Anyway, that's it. Hopefully somebody found some of this useful. And that's about it, unless there's any more questions.
Let's give a second to see if Jason has any more questions or if anybody else has any more questions before we call it a night.
Yeah, they obfuscate their payment structure too. So you will never know how much it's going to cost you until you get the bill after the fact. And it's crazy. Like I, you know, one of my clients, they put everything up in the cloud and there's constantly pressure to shut things down. And do you really need to run this virtual machine? It's like, well, yeah, because I don't have it in the back room anymore. You told us to put it in the cloud. So now you got to pay for it. Jason, yeah, what do you have in your basement? Fair enough. If I could do it on Raspberry Pis, I would consider it. But right now, all of this stuff got saved from the landfill by going into my basement.
So if you ever have to justify your home lab, you might be able to do some sort of calculate some environmental impact that you've reduced by saving computers that would have gone into the landfill right away.
Yeah, but, you know, the age of these guys, the ones coming out nowadays are probably more power efficient, too. So there is that argument to be made as well. I don't know. I don't know what's right. These are conversations over a beer after the talks that we should be having, because I'm sure, you know, there's multiple people on here that have stuff at home that they've managed to convince themselves that it's time for it to go, you know, thank it for its service. But here's the trash heap.
Yeah. Well, one day we'll all be vaccinated, and then we'll actually be meeting again, which will be nice.
Yep. Yippers. All right, guys. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your questions. Like I said, I hope I haven't bored you silly, and I hope this was of some value to you folks.
Oh, wait a minute. There's the most important item from Jason. The last question: Have the electrical company or the police thought you had a grow up in your house, Bob?
Not yet.
Not yet. Well, it's not as illegal as it used to be, so you may have missed your opportunity.
Well, before I mentioned one of my buddies using ESP32s, he does his own growing, and that's one of the things that he does. He does actuators and stuff like that, like watering, or at least that's what he was planning on doing. I don't know how far he got with it, but yeah. No, there's no grow up in my basement. Are you kidding? Too much of a geek for that.
Well, the moisture would interfere with the servers.
That's right. Although there is stuff growing in my backyard, if you want to call it that, that I can't identify. I didn't put it there, but I'm not sure what the hell it is. I'm pretty sure it's some kind of weed. You seriously had 400 amp service run to your house? Jeez. Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Kitchener-Waterloo Linux User Group audio podcast. Our monthly meetings are free of charge and open to all, so please join us if you are around. We meet on the first non-holiday Monday of each month from 7 to 9 p.m. in Kitchener. Please visit kwlug.org for upcoming topics, for directions, and for additional meeting information. In addition to attending a meeting, you can participate in the KWLUG community by joining our email discussion list, by offering to present a topic, or just by spreading the word about this podcast. Thanks also to IndieServe Networks, archive.org, and CCJ Clearline for hosting our website and multimedia files, to the Working Center for offering meeting space, and to the many people who participate in the KWLUG community. Until next time, goodbye world.